Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we've just had a statement from the GAA on that Irish Independent front page story. The headline is Dublin GAA stars hold secret training despite COVID rules, and they have the pictures to prove it. Well, the GAA say now, it is with frustration and extreme disappointment that the GAA acknowledges reports today of a potential breach of both our own COVID guidelines and those of the government relating to the restrictions in place around team training. Less than 48 hours ago, the association reiterated its commitment to these current guidelines and called for continued compliance in the weeks ahead. The GAA will pursue the allegations with the units in question at the earliest opportunity and will invoke any necessary disciplinary process as appropriate. The statement goes on. While we acknowledge the overwhelming majority of counties and clubs have complied in an appropriate and responsible way with the restrictions currently in place, we once again call on our members and units to uphold the integrity of the association as part of our ongoing efforts to play our role in thwarting the virus and ensuring a return to activity when it's safe to do so. That's a statement from the GAA, which we have just got to hand this morning. Now, earlier this week, the trial got underway of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin over the death of George Floyd last May. Now, Chauvin is charged with murder and manslaughter. He's been accused of killing Floyd by pinning him to the pavement for what prosecutors said was 9 minutes 29 seconds. The trial has brought the spotlight once again to issues surrounding systematic racism and racial injustice in the United States and indeed further afield. It was the death of George Floyd and the subsequent Black Lives Matter protests that led my next guest to create an online resource called What White People Can Do Next, and that's where her book of the same name emerged, and follows on from the huge success of her first book, Don't Touch My Hair. Author, academic and broadcaster Emma Dabry, you're very welcome to the programme. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Claire. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Thank you for joining us. Now, as I explained there, your latest book was written after those protests that followed the death in 2020 of George Floyd. Will you just talk to me about that period of time, how it influenced you, your thinking and the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the one hand, I had never seen conversations about race and racism, you know, be so mainstream and have so many people coming on board to talk about these issues, you know, that until recently had been quite taboo or things that just weren't kind of in the popular consciousness or the kind of mainstream discourse. So to me, that was a really exciting opportunity. But one of the things that I saw that was troubling me a great deal was my PhD looks at the construction of racial categories. And one of the things that race was invented, because race is a social construct that was invented in the 17th century with a very specific purpose in mind. One of the rationales behind its invention was to give it this truth status that it was like a biological reality and that there was like kind of a biological and immutable difference between the people that came to be known as the white race and the people that came to be known as the black race in the 17th century. And what I saw a lot of the anti-racist movement doing was, you know, kind of reinforce, like while it was saying, yes, racism is bad, it was acting as though there is another outcome other than racism while we continue to see the world through the lens of a black race and a white race and the biological truth. So what my work really tries to do is like mainstream the history of how race was invented. It's an English colonial innovation, which they invented, and it's very related to the Irish. We first see it, the idea of a white race introduced in colonial Barbados in a set of laws, in a set of slave codes in 1661. And it's a reaction to these uprisings that are repeatedly occurring where indentured Irish who've been like sent to Barbados by Cromwell are joining forces with enslaved Africans and attacking the English and sometimes Scottish landlords that exploit both of their labor. I'll point out the Irish were never slaves. They were indentured laborers, though. And so them seeing a class interest and using that to kind of attack the English landlords. That was really dangerous and threatening to the status quo. One of the things that this new idea of a white race did was to give those indentured laborers a sense that they had more in common with other white people, even when they were of a different class, and use that class division to exploit them. And so then we see the same thing happen in Virginia.
It was grounded in protecting capitalism and protecting the wealthy class.
Absolutely. And it's also at the same time that the capitalist system that we still live under today, that has obviously kind of morphed into a more rapacious neoliberalism since the 1970s. But it's that historical period and that part of the world, that point in time, is where we also see the burgeoning form of the form of capitalism that we still live under. So that invention of race and that origin story of capitalism are intimately interlinked. And that context is always entirely missing from the kind of mainstream discussion of anti-racism, which to me problematically reinforces this kind of truth status of race that we should be doing our best to dissolve. And my work is all about creating coalitions and people understanding that lots of different people are exploited in different ways, and that like poor white people are also exploited, and identifying those points of shared exploitation, using that to create coalitions, also looking at the environmental destruction that's going on at the moment. It's the same forces, that have a disregard for black lives, that have a disregard for the poor, that have a disregard for women, that have a disregard for the very earth itself. And through identifying that same source of exploitation, we can build coalitions and create mass movements, which will be far more effective.
So for us, for white people, as we read mm-hmm. your book and listen to what you have to say, you're asking us to stop denying that we have racist beliefs, because in a sense, how could we not?
So the point that I make is racism has to be understood as, at this stage, it's just ordinary. Race was invented to create racism. And that system was put in play. Race was created specifically with the intention of mind to enshrine this idea of a superiority associated with whiteness and an inferiority associated with blackness, to justify the enslavement of Africans, on which the Western economies were becoming increasingly dependent on. So enshrined into the beginnings of the idea of whiteness is a notion of superiority. So when we know that history, it becomes not surprising that racist ideas, are diffuse throughout society. It's not an anomaly. That's what whiteness was created to do. So it's not like, oh my God, that person's a racist, shock horror. These ideas are ordinary ideas that have been, normalized throughout our societies for centuries. We've inherited that history. So it's nobody needs to feel responsibility about what their ancestors did, but what we have responsibility for is what we choose to do next. Okay. So that's my point. And I also, just very quickly, I just set up as well, the name is a provocation. By the second or third page, I've identified how there's no way I would be talking to a generic category of white people that exist across the world and giving them some sort of instruction. I set up the notion of whiteness so that I can unpack its invention. So a lot of people have been triggered, quote unquote, by the title. But the title is, I'm responding to the way mainstream liberal anti-racism forms the debate, and I'm responding to that, and then I'm deconstructing it.
So then when you say, and I'm taking this from the online toolkit that was published just before the book came along, but you say stop trying to be a good person, and it sounds as though you're frustrated with, I don't know whether it's the outpouring on Twitter after, something like the George Floyd situation happens, and what is it about that prompts you to say stop trying to be good about this?
Yeah, like I make the point that black people don't need charity or benevolence. Black people don't need allyship. What we need is, what everyone needs is solidarity. Like the inequalities perpetuated by capitalism are destructive and their association with the invention of whiteness, you know, are destructive to everybody. They're destructive to the earth, which cannot sustain this the kind of infinite growth that is required, you know, to fuel capitalism. So it's about creating solidarity rather than charity. So the book is all about building coalition. There's a quote that I use, and it's like, "I don't need your help." It's from Fred Moten, a theorist whose work I love. And he says, "I don't need your help. I just need you to recognize that this shit is killing you too." So,
and then, just interested as well in your own experience here, which I know you've talked about in Ireland, which you've talked about in the past. So let's not go back to that. But you did move country. You moved country. It's a huge fundamental thing to do. And I'm wondering, is your experience where you live now much different to what you felt here?
I feel like I'm going to ground that, like, first of all, with saying, like, I like absolutely like love Ireland, and like my Irishness is like such a fundamental like part of me. But with that being said, when I was growing up, there were very, very few black people or people of color or people that were kind of different. Actually, people of color is not a term that I like to use. I don't think I use it in the book, actually, but there were very few non-white people, and but there were very, very there was a lot of ideas about black people, and there were a lot of stereotypes about black people, and of course there were, because that's what whiteness as a construct has been kind of, you know, set up to do. So because there were so few people like me, but there were very, very strong kind of stereotypes and prejudices about black people, I was the subject of a lot of that, and it was just very exhausting. So I wanted to live somewhere. I wanted to move somewhere where I wouldn't feel such isolation, where I wouldn't constantly be like, "You're the first black person I've ever met," and all that comes with that. Often not very positive, often quite negative. Mm-hmm. Ireland has, you know, changed massively since I left. And if I could afford a house in Dublin, I'd happily move back.
Today with Claire Byrne.
Oh, sorry, we were interrupted there. But you would come back here. That's interesting to hear. And just your description there of people saying, "Oh, you're the first person, black person I've ever met." I would imagine for a lot of people 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, that was probably true.
Oh yeah, they weren't lying. They weren't lying at all. And, you know, sometimes it was just the curiosity that comes along with that. But for them, while it's the first time for them to say that and to have that experience, for me, this is just something that's happening constantly. So it becomes very exhausting. And while some people, just a genuine kind of curiosity, other people, it was not just that. There was hostility and there was racism. You know, they had many people had very prejudiced ideas about black
people. Even if I think about growing up and being the subject of genuine curiosity and somebody innocently saying that to me, as you say, that is exhausting. Who wants to be have that focus, that lens?
And constantly, you know, from the time I was 4 or 5 until I left. So, yeah, it was too much.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more then about the toolkit. And you talk about stopping the denial, stop trying to be a good person. Can you explain to me why you say abandon guilt?
Abandon guilt, yeah, because you often hear people saying, "I can't be held responsible for what my ancestors did." And I actually, like, yeah, that's fine. Like, I'm not saying you should be held responsible for what your ancestors did or that you should feel guilt about the past, but you do have a responsibility in the present in terms of what you do. And denying the truth of that history, denying the invention of race and why whiteness was created and the advantages that started to come along with being racialized as white, denying that is something that you have responsibility for, you know? So that's what I mean. Also, the focus, sorry, from a good person. And yeah, another point is we live in, obviously, like, neoliberal capitalism has kind of like really eroded collectivities, you know, and collective action. Everything is about the individual. Even the way we express, even the way we do our activism, it's all about the individual. So I want to shift the focus from like the good individual and this fetishization of privilege, interpersonal privilege, to actually thinking about, you know, redistribution of wealth, how society can be made more just and equal for everybody.
Emma, we could continue our conversation, but unfortunately we have to leave it there for now. The book is called What White People Can Do Next by Emma Dabbery, and it's published by Penguin Books. Emma, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome. Thanks a million, Claire.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.